Hey everyone, it's Jamison Cable of the Land Between the Meadows Kentucky History Podcast. I just want to say thank you for your support and listening to this episode. For all the updates on our podcast and YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kentucky History Channel, like and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at KY History Pod. If you're enjoying the podcast, give us a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the podcast platform that you're listening to. If you're looking for ways to support the podcast, an easy and simple way is to share it on Facebook or any other social media and tell your friends. You can also go to audibletrial.com/KYHistoryPod and get a free book of your choice. And finally, you can visit patreon.com/KYHistoryPod if you want extra content from us. If you're already a patron, thank you for your support. It means so much to us. All the links I've mentioned are in the description of the podcast, so go check them out. Thanks again for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. And remember, if it's not about Kentucky, it ain't worth a hill of beans. Welcome back, everybody, to the Land Between the Meadows, a Kentucky History Podcast. We're here again looking at the Civil War a little bit. We're going to talk about Braxton Bragg.
Woohoo!
Woo! You know, nothing like the country divided, fighting against each other.
I'm into it, man. We're here now.
So
we got a Civil War going on right now.
I know.
Cooking on the front burner.
Braxton Bragg, interesting fella. We talked about him a little bit, how big of a jerk
kind
he was.
Of. He's ignorant.
But more importantly, we're focused on the Battle of Perryville, which, you know, what happened in Kentucky and Boyle County. So how are we starting this one?
Well, we've already said Braxton Bragg's a jerk, and I want to start with that. You know, Braxton Bragg was probably, hands down, of all the generals on both sides in the Civil War, was the poorest general ever. He was really dumb. He was ignorant. And not only was he stupid and ignorant as a commander, but as a person, he was a low life.
Mm-hmm.
He really was. So, you know, instead of always talking about good things about people, Bragg was a freaking idiot. And he couldn't get along with anyone.
Yeah.
All the people that served around him hated him.
Mm-hmm.
Here's some of his personal things. He never took blame for anything.
Yeah.
He blamed everything. Does that sound familiar? He blamed everything on somebody else.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Constantly.
Yes.
And he berated people. He called them names.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, here we go.
Yeah.
I mean, he just belittled people. He hurt their feelings. He said harsh things to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just things that were just so unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And he was just a total jerk. He had no tactics. Well, I hate to say no tactics. Really, he had no tactics at all as a general. He believed in just frontal assaults.
Uh-huh.
You know, just
constantly.
Oh, they're set up on the hill and they got our
artillery.
Let's go get them, boys. You know, and
fire
and
the cannon.
Yeah, just fire the cannon. Cannon fire. You know, he did that. You know, we talked about Breckinridge, John C. Breckinridge, and Breckinridge just, you know, at Stones River, for instance, you know, Breckinridge, you know, Bragg ordered him. And Breckinridge complained. He said, man, they're going to just cut us up and they'll kill us all. And,
you know,
what are you thinking? And you want me to get out in front of them, which he did, and lead them, you know, in direct assault into people behind fortifications with heavy artillery and you're wide open in a field, just like Gettysburg, you know, and Pickett's Charge, all over again. Well, that was Bragg, and you know, I think it was the Battle of Chickamauga that he did well in. Somehow, it was just a freak accident. He got the Union on the run, and then he just stopped.
Yeah.
You know, he just stopped. He wouldn't follow up, and all of his officers were just like, man, this is what I've been waiting for the whole war, is to get them on the run and then go after them, you know, and punish them. And the same thing, you know, when Johnson was killed at Shiloh and Breckinridge, you know, had them on the run, was pushing them into the river. It was their whole design was to force the Union back into Pittsburgh Landing before they could get reinforced and drive them right into this river, you know, make them swim the river, you know. And they pushed them and got right up to the brink, and it was 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and Bragg said, ordered halt. You know, it's the end of the day. Let's stop. And Breckinridge
dinner
was
time,
like,
boys.
Dinner time, boys. And, and you know, it was like, you know, Breckinridge was like, oh, my God, you know, I can't believe he's ordering us to stop.
Yeah.
And this is what we've dreamed of. This is where all of our plans and everything were for. We finally got him on a run. And then you talk about Shiloh, and you talk about the Hornet's Nest and the Peach Orchard. You know, the Hornet's Nest is this place out in the middle of the field that's just heavy artillery, just, you know, wide open field across. And Bragg, you know, sends probably Breckinridge, I'm not sure, out there to attack it. And they just annihilate the Confederates and they retreat. And Bragg says, go get them again, boys. And so, you know, they've been doing well up until this time. So they just take them wide open field again. They charge right across and they just annihilate the Confederates, you know, just kill them. Come back. You know, they do it again. They get annihilated again. Just hundreds, thousands of them dying, screaming and everything. Bragg comes up and, you know, and Breckinridge says, you know, it looks like things are a little tough out there. You know what I mean? Like we've lost half our army.
Yeah.
You know, this is not good. Can we go around to the side or bypass them or something? You know, Bragg says, no, charge ahead. And he just totally annihilated the Confederates.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, of course, it wasn't Bragg charging. He's just ordering it.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, it's...
What I mean, yeah, I don't know about the entire Civil War, but would it be safe to say that Bragg was part of the undoing?
Oh, totally.
You know?
And he was, you know, and here's no better stance when you talk about Jefferson Davis, you know. Unlike Lincoln, Jefferson Davis was very political, just like a lot of Southerners, you know, and he wanted his, the old boys club, you know. And Bragg had served with him in the Mexican War. And they were buddies. I think they roommated maybe at West Point. Maybe not roommates, but they were the same class. And they were buddies there. Jefferson Davis never really did like Bragg. But Bragg had a real high social standing.
Yeah.
And Davis evidently was envious of that. And so he kept Bragg on as a failing general.
You know,
where Lincoln would replace people if they'd get the job done.
Yeah.
And so Bragg just, you know, he was in charge of the Western Theater. Bragg was in charge of the Army of Mississippi and then the Army of Tennessee and, you know, the Western Theater. And really, Shiloh and Perryville were the two big highlights of the Western Theater. And Bragg lost them both.
Yeah.
He was just a real idiot in the way that he thought and so forth. When you get to Perryville, Perryville is really the high water mark of the Western Theater. You know, the loss of Perryville and the retreat back into Tennessee by the Confederacy. That was, you know, a bad thing for the South. And of course, Bragg was responsible for all of it. As usual. I mean, he's just a real jerk. Everything you talk about Bragg. The only thing he did was, you know, the army, he had like one division, I think, Bragg did, and Buell, who was the northern commander, had four, I believe. And even though Buell had four, he really screwed up in the Battle of Perryville, and that's kind of what let Bragg do so well there, if you want to say he did well. But Bragg got to Perryville first, and, you know, there's a horrible drought on, and there's no water. And there's a big spring near what today is Bragg's headquarters there on the Chaplain River, you know, Chaplain River, just outside of Perryville, about a quarter of a mile. And that's and there's a house there, an old brick house still there today, and that was where Bragg had his headquarters. And right down the hill from that house is a huge cave with fresh running water out of it. And there was a pool of cool, clean water, which was incredible. And Bragg made his headquarters there, right there on the spot. You know, here's two armies that are just dehydrated because there's no water. The heat's incredible. The whole Midwest has just, you know, been dry for a long, long time. The Chaplain River is dried up except for just a few spots of mossy, algae-infested water. And... actually, the battle started when a Union outpost there at Bottoms House came down. There was a pool of water there, and the Confederates, a group of them, met the Union cavalry, and they started skirmishing right there over the water hole. They started fighting over water. And, you know, that was pretty incredible. I'm not going to give unless you want to. I'm not going to give all the details of the Battle of Paravel.
Well, there's a whole lot of, I mean, there's a whole
there's
lot.
There's a whole lot. And there's so many experts on it. Mm-hmm. And if I start talking about it, I'm sure everybody's he's like Bragg. He didn't know beans and all from apple butter. Even though I lived over there for 15 years and studied the Civil War every day and walked mm-hmm. every piece of the ground of the Battle of Paravel. Uh-huh. You know, hunted for relics and found Confederate belt buckles in my front yard and casket mm-hmm. markers from Bottom, who was a casket maker. It was a famous battle there, and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, there's loads of books written
loads
about
of
it.
Books I mean. On it, the Battle of Chaplain mm-hmm. Hills, da 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 da. But and also, we know about war a lot as a first source through mm-hmm. diaries.
Yeah,
and one diary that was uncovered a few years ago by a Confederate soldier who was marching, a Union soldier, marching from Louisville. And he said, you know, that talked about how thirsty and how dry and how hot everything was. Mm-hmm. And said there was a farm pond that was about empty. It was just full of scum and mud, but there mm-hmm. was a little bit of muddy water in it. And he went and filled his canteen, and he was filling his canteen. He looked in the pond, and there was a bloated, dead mule in the pond. Oh, that's what they were drinking. They all rushed down, and that was in his diary.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they all filled their canteens with this bloated, dead mule laying there in the water. I mean, that's how desperate they were.
Yeah, desperate times. Whew.
And there was another time that, you know, in the Battle of Paravel, one of the Union regiments, they're right in front of the Bottoms house. Mm-hmm. I go down there quite a bit. You can go into the park that way. There's a, kind of some trails. It's now a wildlife refuge. A lot of it is. I'm going to have a picnic out there next week, as a matter of fact. My family's coming up from North Carolina.
Awesome. Yeah.
So they were filling their canteens, and they stacked their rifles uh-huh. about 50 yards from where they went down a small bank.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Confederates came up on them and just shot the holy fire out of them. Mm-hmm. You know, they caught them down there with their pants down.
Yeah. You know, literally.
Standing in the grease. So that was one thing. And just, you know, several personal stories that I can tell is my first house that I lived in was an old log house over in Troy, Kentucky, Woodford County. Mm-hmm. Probably about, I'm going to guess about 18 miles, maybe 20 miles from Perryville. Mm-hmm. And it was an old two-story log house, and the family lived there was called the Black family. That was mm-hmm. their last name. And they had a son who had joined, I believe it was the Confederate Army, like 3 days before. Mm-hmm. And the mother, they could hear rumbling from the Battle of Paravel. They knew there was a contest going on because even 15, 18 miles away, they could hear it somewhere.
Yeah.
And that night, she woke her husband up and told him that she had had a dream mm-hmm. and said that their son had been shot and he was on a hill leaning up against a cedar tree.
Yeah.
And was mortally wounded seriously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they got in their carriage, their buggy, and they drove the 20 miles over through Mercer County. Mm-hmm. And as the sun came up, of course, it was just devastation everywhere, yeah. People dying. And they drove through the countryside, and sure enough, on a hill, they saw a cedar tree, and they drove up to it, and there was their son. And he had been shot through his body.
Whoa.
And they put him in the carriage, bound him up, and took him back to Troy. And nursed him back to health, and he lived.
Wow.
And that was a story with the house that I lived in and, restored there in Troy. So, you know, strange things happen.
That is a quite.
They were clairvoyant. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of stories like that about Paravel. You know, there's some interesting facts, too, just in general about Perryville. And, mm-hmm. you know, as a fourth and fifth grade public school teacher that taught social studies, and in fourth grade Kentucky history, one of the questions that's always brought out is that Perryville was the largest battle fought in the state of Kentucky, the largest Civil mm-hmm. War battle, mm-hmm. largest battle of any kind,
yeah.
but of Civil War. There were actually 72,000 combatants, and there were 55,000, wow. over 55,000 Union soldiers, and almost 17,000 Confederate soldiers.
Oh, so
In the area.
No, in the... Okay.
But the Union Army, and this is really interesting. The Union Army didn't employ... there were only 20,000 Union troops, even though he had almost 60,000, 72,000, or almost 60,000, I guess. Union troops, only 20,000 of them were used against the 16,000 Confederates were engaged. And that was because Buell, who was, if you know the geography, if you come from Springfield towards Perryville, you go to Bardstown, then Springfield, then Perryville.
Yeah.
About, 5 or 6 miles outside of Perryville, Don Carlos Buell, who was the Union commander, had made his headquarters, but the day before he'd fallen off his horse.
Oh.
And he injured himself.
Yeah.
And he was laying around in bed moaning that, you know, he hurt his leg or his back or something. And his generals kept coming in and saying, you know, looks like there's going to be a major confrontation.
Uh-huh.
You know, just it's underway.
Yeah.
We've hit the main division of Confederate soldiers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he goes, you're crazier than hell. He goes, I can hear and I haven't heard a sound or a word. So he denied it. Uh-huh. He was in total denial.
Yeah.
Practically the first, you know, stages of the battle.
And
it was called acoustic shadow.
Uh-huh.
And it's because there's rolling hills that the hills going in that direction block the sound waves.
Uh-huh.
So just on the other side of the hill, practically, you can have a major battle raging, the cannon. And on the other side of the hill, where they blocked it, you couldn't hear it.
Wow.
Then he couldn't hear it, and he was in total denial. And his officers would come in and say, sir, you know, it's an emergency. We got to go, man. We got this, that, and the other. And he goes, there's nothing going on. They're just some people, you know, scraping.
Calm down. And, we have number 3-1. We're okay.
That's right. And he only used a third of his army. So,
wow.
You know, and that was the reason that Bragg, he pretty much won the field somehow and did well, retreated during the night, left the campfires burning, and all of his soldiers retreated on through Bryantsville and down through Cumberland Gap into Tennessee to get out of there because Bragg realized that he was up against nearly 60,000, you know, the next day, even though he had pushed them back.
How long did it last?
There was skirmishing, I think, one day, you know, around the water hole, and then the next day, it was pretty much one day.
Yeah.
And people that, from diaries and things, I mean, said both Union and Confederate, and some were in the Battle of Shiloh, which was a terrible battle, and all these Civil War battles said that Perryville, that one day of fighting, was the most fierce fighting, and actually equal fighting that they had ever experienced in all their years of the Civil War. And there's one place, I think it's called Peter's Hill, that these Union cannons were there, and the Confederates were just like charging them blankly with bayonets and fighting them off. And the Confederates like took this hill like 3 different times and were pushed off of it.
Yeah.
But they were fighting with knives and bayonets. They're shooting and they just engage each other. And they said, the Confederates said, one of them in the diary, there was so much blood spilled at the top of the hill and on the side of the hill that they couldn't get their footing, that they were slipping and falling down. There was so much blood infused on the side of the hill. I mean, that just gives you a picture. Another, I talked to a lawyer over in Lancaster who had done some studying of the parable and used to go over their battle. And he said that he read some documents that said that in different areas of the parable that they were so close to each other, shooting at each other, that people would become nervous. Remember, these are muzzle loaders, and they would shove the ramrod down, and they would forget to pull the ramrod out, and they would fire it, and there were people laying around that looked like Indians with arrows sticking out of their stomach where they'd fired the ramrod by mistake, and they were just like porcupined.
Yeah, wow.
Laying all over the place, and they said that was a real clue that things were fairly intense. Like, you're just, you know, frantic to get your gun loaded and shoot, you know, or you're going to be killed yourself. So those were, you know, just some different stories. There were 21 different states within the forces of the Battle of Perryville. There were soldiers from Alabama and Arkansas, even from Florida, of course, Georgia, and then from the north, Illinois, Indiana, Kansas Regiment, from the south, Louisiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, from the south, Mississippi, North Carolina, New York, soldiers from New York, Ohio had tons, Pennsylvania had tons, Wisconsin had tons, of course, Tennessee was a major player, Texas, and even Virginia. And Perryville, you know, is considered the high watermark of the Confederacy West, much as Gettysburg would be the high watermark of the East.
Yeah.
So it was a really important battle. You know, historians say that, and, you know, it was only after dark that Bragg realized that, you know, he was totally outnumbered at Paraville, and mm-hmm. and it was Joe Wheeler, who was out on the Lebanon Road, that came in and told him, said, "Hey, I'm holding off, you know, two, you know, regiments of federal troops, and you know they're going to come busting through in the morning. You know, you better be ready for them. You're going to be outnumbered 3-1."
Yeah.
And but they said that Bragg was in a mood that. Bragg thought that when he came into Kentucky, mm-hmm. came up from Tennessee, he came into Kentucky, that he said that he thought he was like, you know, God's gift to the earth, that Kentuckians would like run out, all the farm boys would run mm-hmm. out and join forces, and his army would swell. He came into Kentucky in a way to recruit.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen.
Oh.
And so he was in a mood, mm-hmm. everyone mm-hmm. said, when the Battle of Paraville started. He couldn't believe it. And Kirby Smith, who was in Frankfort, who was a Confederate cavalry officer, he's the one that told Bragg that he was going to just ride through, and he was a real gallant cavalry mm-hmm. officer, that people would just come out from everywhere and join the Confederate cause because the Confederates were so wonderful, and Kentucky didn't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But Kirby Smith had promised Bragg that it would just be all the way. So mm-hmm. the combination of factors with him being outnumbered 3-1 and, you know, Bragg always in retreat, even if he was winning, you know, mm-hmm. he wanted to go back, even though he had won a tactical victory that day. October the 8th, we need to say the date, I guess, 1862.
Pivotal point in the war.
You know, he cut out.
Mm-hmm.
But it may have been best that he did. But he was winning the battle, and he was in position, and he had things going for him. You know, other generals wouldn't have probably done that, maybe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But as we said, Paraville was the second bloodiest battle.
Yeah.
Of the Western theater in the whole war. It produced 7,621 total casualties.
Wow.
4,220 for the Union, 3,401 for the Confederate. And last week, I was at a yard sale in Mercer County, just on the backside of the Battle of Paraville, and a guy had a Confederate Tennessee rifle he brought out of his house. You know, he was selling all these knickknacks.
Yeah.
And he said, I asked him if he had any guns. He goes, yeah, and he told me the story. He had a Tennessee rifle, and it was... documented. He knew the man's name that had it,
mm-hmm.
and he died. The man had been wounded and had, you know, been cared for down there.
Yeah,
knew it was like the 17th Tennessee Regiment,
mm-hmm.
and it was a really very original, beautiful gun. I bought it from him.
Yeah,
and took it up to Lawrenceburg, Indiana, and sold it to a lawyer. But it was really nice when you get the ambiance of something tells uh-huh. you all the history.
Yeah.
Of it. So I was real pleased to have that and real proud of it. I wish I could find more. But there were, they told me, and I had the only original wooden casket made in Paraville mm-hmm. in my antique store that I had down there for a long time, and I left it with the antique store. As mm-hmm. far as I know, it's still down there. Mm-hmm. People can see it. There was a lumber yard down on the corner of Paraville, and that's where we're making caskets. And they said, local people said that up to a year,
yeah.
After the Battle of Paraville, people were still dying from the wounds.
Wow.
And many people that were wounded that recovered stayed there and married. These young soldiers married.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a friend that was at his great-grandfather was in the Battle of Paraville, and he was from Tennessee. And
mm-hmm.
it was a Cummins. A lot mm-hmm. of people know the Cummins family. And there was a hospital there known as a Confederate hospital. It was a house. They turned mm-hmm. a house, the McKnight's mm-hmm. house, into... a hospital, and his kin were in the hospital, and he was telling a family story that after the Battle of Paraville, the next day after, there was a Union sniper who had climbed up in a tree
oh, yeah.
and was actually shooting. The wounded were laying out in the yard and stuff,
yeah.
and he was shooting some of the wounded and doctors, everything else, you know, from the tree. And someone, he said, "Give me a damn gun." He gave a gun, and he said it was way off up in the tree. And he leaned out the window of the Nyhester, shot him out of the tree. And that was a family story. So wow. that ended the Union sniping. Yeah, but I mean, you know, stories like that are kind of interesting, I
mm-hmm,
think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he told that of his family story. He laid back down in bed and he died. But he married the woman that was taking care of him.
Wow.
It's,
That's interesting to see how those families, people ended up staying.
Yeah.
Which I would assume to travel would be kind of...
Right.
If you were recovering from a wound and, you know.
The 16th Tennessee had 219 casualties out of 370 engaged, which was, they lost 59, over 59% of their regiment they suffered the highest percentage of casualties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They were the ones charging those cannons, I think, and going hand to hand, the blood slipping up and down the hill, slip and slide. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, the battle started over water. It wasn't over water. Buell was trying to find Bragg cut him off, you know, as he was going towards central Kentucky and Harrodsburg and so forth. Yeah. But they were fighting over water. They said that it was so dry, the Ohio River at Louisville, that some of Buell's people that came from Indiana, some of them wanted to desert, I guess.
Yeah.
And they got to Louisville, and it was so hot and dry, and there wasn't enough water that a whole bunch of them just walked across the Ohio River. No bridge. Just walked across it into Indiana and went back home. So that was kind of interesting. Yeah,
very dry time.
But the microbes in the water that they did drink and ingested, because they would drink anything wet, like I said, the drowned mule in the water, you know. Was not making good. Them all sick. Oh, they're all sick and squirting diarrhea and everything else. Really,
the runs.
You know, we on this podcast we like to talk about diarrhea and the squirts.
It happens.
And every man was loading his pants and squirting because it was such bad. I mean, I know we think it's funny, but man, so you know what kind of shape it is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just like all the Confederate troops.
No wonder they're shaking when they're loading the rifles.
Really shaking like crazy. It's just like the Battle of Augusta, Kentucky. I got a shop up there, you know, and they were all shaking and squirting too. But they had camped in a vineyard the night before, and they were hungry. They were out of food, and so they ate the green grapes.
Uh-huh.
And the next day, the battle, they were all had the squirts. Because they ate the whole, they destroyed the vineyard and the winery up there, Baker Bird's Winery. It's real famous.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a place where people go and head that way. But their whole winery was totally, the Confederate troops ate the green grapes. And they weren't ripe and got the squirts. And like I said, you know, Bragg was at one of those springs in the Chaplain River. But just like Bragg was an idiot, not like Buell was too, because he laid around on his cot, you know, eating pom-poms and sugar pops and stuff. And his officers kept giving him reports. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his failure to act in a timely manner earned him many enemies within his own army.
Yeah.
They were so angry because, you know, they had him, three to one and surrounded.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't order the attack, you know. So... And, you know, I was telling you what a bloody and hard-fought, famous Confederate diarist, Sam Watkins, as I was saying earlier, declared Perryville the hardest fighting that he experienced in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Watkins was a soldier in the 1st Tennessee,
and
he fought in every major battle that the Confederate unit was engaged in, and that include Shiloh, Corinth, Mississippi, Stones River. That's where they had Breckinridge charge and annihilated the Orphan Brigade, Bragg. Chickamauga, Chattanooga, the Atlanta Campaign, Franklin, Nashville. In his famous memoirs published after the war, Washington said of Perryville, quote, "I was in every battle, skirmish, and march that was made by the 1st Tennessee Regiment during that war, and I do not remember of a harder contest and more evenly fought battle than that of Perryville."
Wow. Right in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. He said he was locked. He said the 1st Tennessee was locked in hand-to-hand struggle for the Union cannons. He said, "Such obstinate fighting I never seen before or since."
So they charged the cannon?
Oh, yeah. With
on foot?
Yes, with bayonets.
On foot.
And there were all kinds of Union soldiers on foot with bayonets that met them.
Oh, okay.
And it said, "The iron storm that passed through our ranks," this is from his diary, I'm looking at it now, "mangling and tearing men to pieces. At Perryville, Watkins would find that both his hat and his cartridge box had been holed by enemy fire, making him one of the lucky ones."
Yeah. Wow.
Isn't that something?
Had some bravery there.
And even Bragg said, you know, even the coward Bragg said that for the time committed, engaged, it was the severest and most desperately contested engagement within my knowledge, which his knowledge is questionable. And they also said there were some small Henry repeating rifles, that there was actually a general store in Louisville, and that they know that at least one and maybe two or three Union troops bought, officers bought Henry repeating rifles, and for the first time they were used in the Western Theater at Paravel. And it's also kind of interesting to know that there were two officers at Paravel whose sons became famous World War II generals.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Buckner, Simon Buckner, the commander of one-third of the Confederate Army at Paravel. He was in, and then his son, Simon B. Buckner, Jr., was the lieutenant general in charge of American land forces on the island of Okinawa. And he was actually killed by Japanese artillery.
Wow.
But he was a general, too. Paravel was the first battle for a young officer, Arthur MacArthur.
Arthur MacArthur?
Yes. Would earn the Medal of Honor, the Battle of Missionary Ridge, and his father, Douglas MacArthur, who would go on great fame in World War II in Korea, were the only father and son combination in American history to both have won a Medal of Honor.
Wow. Huh. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And then, you know, we talk about all these statues, Mr. Cable. It's kind of interesting. I'm not sure if it's the only one, but the after the Battle of Paravel, the United States government built a statue paid by the United States government honoring the Confederate dead at Paravel by the U.S. government.
Wow.
And it's still standing today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was done in 1880. A monument was erected. It says on the monument, erected by the United States. You can go out there and read it before you tear it down.
Wow.
It's a graveyard. They put the Confederates in a mass grave, and they had slaves bury them. What I've heard the story was.
Wow.
And the Paravel battlefield went on for a long time. It wasn't at State Park until 1954.
Wow, really?
90 years after the battle. It was just farmland, and they've been buying up farms around there like crazy. So now it's really large. Like I said, it's a bird sanctuary.
Yeah, bald eagles. You can see bald eagles and everything out there.
You see every damn thing.
Yeah.
Man, I see. Do you see what I saw? Yeah, I'm taking my grandkids out there next week. It's supposed to be 100 degrees.
Yeah.
We're going to stumble around out there and take some hot wieners, as we call them, and cook them.
Bring your sunscreen and some water. Make sure you have some water.
Well, we're going to bring all kinds of water. Kool-Aid, lemonade. Yeah. Largely, Paravel went largely unnoticed, and the local Lions Club down there started saying how important it was. And then as historians begin to look at it again, take another look. They bought up 18 acres. Now there's probably thousands. It has nearly 1,000 acres is now the battlefield. People are contributing money to it. You can get online. It'll tell you, donate now, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Facebook page. Group.
There's a museum out there. It's a small museum. It's kind of nice. And they have markers all around and hiking trails. And you can, you know, read what happened on this spot. And you know, you just walk around. I've walked out there. I've took my dogs, ran my dogs out there.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're supposed to, but there's deer and everything else out there.
Pretty nice place.
It is. I like it. And there's not well attended. You know, there's not a lot of people out there. You can go out there and not see a person a lot of times.
Yeah.
I mean, people have family reunions out there, used to. I don't know what they're doing now with this corona thing.
But, yeah.
But it's a pretty cool place.
Pretty cool. Big event in the Civil War right here in Kentucky, especially, you know, in our own backyard, especially if you are close to Boyle County.
When I lived down at Paravel, we were looking for a small farm, and the Bottoms house, which is riddled with bullets and where the battle started, and it's still there. It's a log house, and there's still, you know, bullet holes in the wall and everything. And so we went out there, my wife and I and son went out there, and when he was about, oh, I don't know, 5 years old. And the realtor was showing us the house, and we almost bought it.
Yeah.
We almost bought that. And I wish I had of in a lot of ways. It was right down by the Chaplain River, had a large tobacco base. And we were walking through the field, found some arrowheads. And I remember my son picked up a rock in the tobacco field.
Yeah.
And you know how kids are? He just turned and threw it.
Yeah.
And he hit the realtor right in the head of the rock, who was a friend of mine, and like nearly knocked him down. And my son was only 4 or 5 years old, but you know how kids are. You know. So, I have to share that. There's another casualty on the battlefield.
Take 10,000 off the prize. Yeah.
That's right. Later, I paid my son, you know, in popsicles. Mickey Mouse bars.
Yeah.
But I had another friend, the lawyer friend, over at Lancaster, and he told me stories, this is 40 years ago, that they used to go over there, and friends of his would walk in the Chaplain River when it was low, like this time of year, it gets dry. And he said you could just pick up cannonballs and broken shards of cannon in the river, bottom area, rock bottom.
Yeah.
He said they were all over the place. And he said friends of his just collected them and found all kinds of artillery shells.
Wow.
Just laying in the water, you know, just laying there in rock, just exposed where the creek was, dry creek bed. So, you know, it was just kind of local stories. And, you know, we lived in Perryville. And, oh, I'll tell you a couple of stories. We lived in Perryville. I did. And we put in a drain, like a 30-foot, maybe 40-foot pipe in our front yard in a ditch for the water to run through and covered it over. And when we were digging the ditch out, we found a Confederate belt buckle.
Yeah.
That was real rare. It's worth probably $1,000. And another time we found in the same area, we found a Spanish real of 1790.
Wow.
That's where, or maybe it was 1776. It was where Harbison's Fort was.
Yeah.
There on the west bank of the Chaplain River, across from El Bundy. And I also lived down the street in an old historic house, and I had a fenced-in backyard, and I had two basset hounds. And, you know, I taught here at Crab Orchard. And when I would go home in the evening, I'd leave my dogs in the fenced-in chain link, big, almost an acre.
Yeah.
And they would dig up bones. And bring them to the gate every day, and they were human bones.
Whoa.
And I got a 5-gallon bucket and filled it with human bones where they had buried them in short graves. And right down the street, maybe 30 or 40 yards, was Dr. Polk's, P-O-L-K.
Yeah.
Was the only doctor there at the time. And they did amputations at his little office, little wooden office there.
Yeah.
And they had arms and legs, according to a diary, stacked up to the eaves of the house on both sides like cordwood.
Wow. Oh.
All the way. You can imagine that. We're talking, what, 14 feet high and maybe 25 feet long on both sides of the house, stacked up, legs and arms that were amputated, like cornwood, cordwood.
I mean, they're probably, chopping them off left and right.
Oh,
I mean,
you know, that's what they did.
Yeah, you got a shot in the arm, that's cutting off.
That's right, leg, anything. Toe, whack her off. Seriously.
Oh.
And I lived right down the street, and maybe they were just burying parts of bodies, or maybe they were just shallow graves of people that had died.
Yeah.
And I lived in another house in Perryville, and on the floorboard in my bedroom was carved a Calvary horse with a crude knife into the floor.
Wow.
And it was where, and there were blood stains where they had wounded laid there, and they were just carving because they were bored.
Yeah.
And I guess he was a Calvary, and he carved a picture of his horse.
Wow. Huh.
I mean, that's pretty far out stuff. Man. Yeah, pretty heavy.
Yeah, people lying there dying. Yeah.
And then another, I tell you, I lived there, man. I was into this. Another house that I was in. I'm not going to say which one because the people don't want us. But there are actually two houses I know of in Perryville. That in the attic there were soldiers lined up wounded. You know, that they were caring for, and they wrote things in pencil.
Wow.
On the ceiling on the old mortared wall, and there were pictures and diagrams and letters to people and love messages all along the wall.
Wow. That is
And someone bought that and they remodeled it, and they didn't, you know, I told them they needed to put plexiglass over it, and they just tore it out and put re-drywall it.
Oh,
all that
man.
Historical stuff.
Man.
It's sad. I mean, people do that all the time.
At least take it out and give it to the museum.
It should have been.
Yeah.
Should have been carefully taken out. Or it could have been just, if you just screwed in plexiglass.
Yeah.
I mean, that would have added the value of it, you know, the historical value. But you know how people are, man.
Yeah.
You know how people are. Let's bulldoze her down.
Yeah.
So, but there's so many things have been lost in time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's one of the reasons our podcast, you know, we try to relive history and, you know, give you a feel of people with diarrhea and what it's really like and dead mules floating, bloated mules in a pond.
It's not the first time we've talked about a dead mule in a pond.
No. That's right. That's right. Up in eastern Kentucky. That's right. Red Mule. Yeah. And that book that you read. That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. But history, man, is really comes alive when you start talking
in,
like that. Really? My son, I'll tell you another story since we're story time. And I think maybe our listeners would rather hear stories than to hear data or something. You know, there were 6,428 that faced each other off. And my son grew up in Perryville, and we loved history and You know, they have a huge reactment there, and sometimes it'd be the national reactment, and the troops would come in town. We owned an antique store, and people were dressed in costume. And I mean, gosh, if you used your imagination, it was just like you were living back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And my son was like 7 or 8 or 9 years old at the time. And we would go out on the night before the reenactment battle. It was had on Sunday afternoon, but we'd go out Saturday night, about 9 o'clock, maybe 10 o'clock at night. All the public would be gone. And there would be rows of tents on the hillsides.
Yeah.
And we would walk through them, and there'd be men telling stories, you know, dressed in uniform, with fires going where they were cooking.
Yeah.
And we would walk through it, and it was so ghostly. It was just like we were back in time.
Wow.
I mean, they were, you know, they were strict. You know, they had to wear the glasses and wire-rimmed glasses, and their guns were stacked.
Yeah.
And, you know, the tin were rattling, and they were laying back smoking clay pipes and stuff. And it was just like, and my son, oh, my gosh. He got into it.
Yeah.
It was so magic. And now, I just want to tell you, if we roll forward, my son is a doctor of American history, PhD, and teaches history in Missouri.
Yeah, that's it.
And teaches colonial history.
Those trips through the...
And that just, that's what we live for every year. And we would spend the evening walking up till midnight and sitting back in the grass, just the two of us, you know, listening to the sounds and imagining that we were back in those times and kind of creeping around. You know, it was like... So trippy.
Man. Yeah.
I mean, I was into it.
That'd be...
He was just like out of his mind. I was out of my mind. And just what a father and son thing.
Yeah.
You know? We just loved history, and just it was real to us. I mean, we were there.
Yeah.
It was heavy, man.
Yeah. It sounds good. It sounds awesome.
Heck yeah.
Take your kids to Civil War reenactments.
Oh, yeah.
They'll become doctors.
Doctors and lawyers.
Yeah.
When they have diarrhea, they'll be able to relate. It's not so bad, son.
Yeah.
Think about the generations that fought, you know, and our family fought in the Civil War. Yeah. So many families did. Mm-hmm. Our family fought with the Army of Tennessee.
I mean,
and I'm not a traitor, so you can call me one if you want.
Well, and that's the connection, I guess, to Kentucky. I mean, Perryville was the biggest battle for sure.
Yes.
But I mean, there's more battles, and you know, there's the people that stayed.
There's a battle here at Perryville.
The Confederate,
Battle here at Perryville.
Yeah. What?
Excuse me, Crab Orchard. I don't know where I am.
Yeah.
I got Perryville on my mind.
Yeah.
Battle
of
Crab
Orchard. You know, in the Baptist Church, there was the Confederate.
Well, we got a cemetery.
There's a cemetery, down the road.
Yeah, and it's got, you know what it's got on it? It's got a quote from Theodore. That we talked about last time, O'Hara.
Oh, yeah.
And the base it's got for the sleeping dead, you know, and all. You know, no rattling sabers anymore and all that. You know, they're free of that.
Yeah.
And it's up on top of a hill, and there's a...
It's a nice cemetery.
It's a real nice cemetery.
Yeah.
You know, when I was younger, and some of the women teachers, we used to jog after school. And we'd jog up there at the top, you know, and then jog back.
Yeah.
And it was a couple of miles. It's a pretty steep hill to run, you know.
It is.
Women would run off and leave me, and I'd be overweight and panting, you know, trying to keep up with them.
They just
run off and leave me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Struggling on the streets of Perryville, you know, looking
at
Crab Orchard. I don't know where I am. I'm in Perryville mode right now. Crab Orchard, thank you. Leave me on the streets of Crab Orchard, you know, the big city. You know, my shorts.
There's a historical marker by the Baptist Church.
Yes.
And then there's graves by the Baptist Church, too.
And they've been bulldozing around that, and I worry about that.
Yeah.
That bothers me, because there's a lot of markers there.
Old markers.
Old markers, Civil War and before.
Yeah.
People died in the 1840s and 50s.
It's an old church.
Yeah. Yes. And then there's, you know, people have done research on all the soldiers that were buried and where they were from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
One thing, talking about Crab Orchard, Crab Orchard straight now. I had a letter, and I sold it to a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the trouble being an antique dealer. You need to have good things, and
that you have all this stuff.
Yeah, sell them. You know, some things you ought to keep, and you don't. But the letter was written by a Confederate soldier. I guess it was after the Battle of Perryville, who camped in Crab Orchard.
Yeah.
And they said that they raided a farmer's house and caught a goose. And they roasted the goose, and they said that it was the best meal that they'd had in 2 years. They roasted a goose here in Crab Orchard, and the whole letter was about the roasted goose and stealing a goose from a local farmer. So I thought that was pretty good.
A bunch of our boys died in battle, but we got us a goose today.
They got us a goose. You know, they remember that good meal.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
Better than hardtack and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But Crab Orchard was a place where John Hunt Morgan would come before the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It was Lexington Green, and they would run out here at the racetrack, you know, Whitley's mm-hmm. racetrack. We've talked about that before. And there were two racetracks, and the women would come out in parasols and watch all the young men, and men would be hanging with their tongues out, you know, at the women. There were so many good-looking women down here. Still are, I guess. And, you know, it was interesting. Those Crab Orchard girls were hot, I guess. Of course, there was a train that came in and out of mm-hmm. here every day. Well, I'm serious. Big, they big were train. Hot. Yeah. They were hot. I don't know if they still are. Or not.
That's up for debate.
Yeah, it's debatable. They are. Can't slight the women. But anyway, it's true. And they come mm-hmm. from everywhere. And it was like a dating thing back then, you know. And it was Sunday afternoon, they'd race, and then they'd have picnics with the girls, mm-hmm. you know, in parasols. And, you know, Crab Orchard had all these springs and hotels and brought mm-hmm. in a lot of high-class people from, you know, all over and for the spring water and dangle their little toes in the water or whatever.
Or heal their wounds.
Heal their wounds or mental wounds. Psychological neurosis, you know.
What's that called?
Whenever that's you what take we a, need. I don't know why the school's so crazy, man. Where are the springs?
When you take what's it called? When you take a pill and it's just a sugar pill, but
yes,
it makes you...
Yes.
It's not a placebo, is
it? It's a placebo.
Placebo.
Yeah, that's it. A placebo. Yeah. Yeah. We need something like that today for people to cool their heels in.
Yeah.
All right. I got my dog in the truck.
All right. Well, that'll wrap this one up.
It's getting hot out there.
We'll talk to you again. I guess we'll journey a little further.
Forward
or back somewhere. Yeah. We'll talk. We'll come up with something to talk about.
Sounds good. We hope you enjoyed the podcast today.
Yes. Connect to us at KY History Pod on Twitter, Facebook. Email us landbetweenthemeadows@gmail.com.
And by the way, Dolly Parton won the contest we had between that and
get it, John G. Fee.
John Fee.
We'll get us a petition going around.
I'm serious.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Bye-bye.